Well, good evening. I invite you to turn to the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18 will be the first of a few passages that we'll be looking at in our study tonight. And as Robert has already mentioned, we'll be wrapping up our study on the questions about the conquest. For the last few Sunday nights, we have been discussing an aspect of God's nature and His character as we see it revealed in the Old Testament. And specifically, His instruction to the nation of Israel in regard to the conquest of Canaan. It is an element that critics point to in their attempt to denounce Christianity. After all, how can a loving God, a merciful God, actually command such violent acts against another group of people? And I got thinking about this in my study through Deuteronomy. It made me think about it a little bit more deeply and try and address the issue head on. As I mentioned, I think in the first lesson, tonight's lesson not going to leave you all feeling warm and fuzzy inside. This is not one of those lessons that, man, you just wanted. Man, I'm just going to go out and serve the Lord this week. But it is informational. It is a question that creates problems in our minds at times, and as I said, I'm not going to be able to come up with any ironclad solution, but what I am trying to do is to frame the issue in the proper perspective using the information that the Bible itself supplies to us. You remember that in the first lesson, we actually looked at three common approaches to the problem and saw that each one of them really are ultimate dead ends. They don't provide a legitimate solution to the issue. One is that we just sort of pit the Old Testament against the New. And yet that doesn't solve anything, because we find numerous references of God's love in the Old Testament and we find numerous references of God's wrath in the New Testament. So this is not a case of where, you know, the God of the Old Testament is one way and the God of the New Testament is another way. The second dead-end approach was that it was a situation of misapplied zeal, that Moses and Joshua simply misunderstood what God commanded. Now, the beauty of the second solution is that it completely and totally exonerates God. The problem with it is that it's the exact opposite of what the Bible actually says. The third one is to suggest that this is just an allegory for spiritual warfare. But that's a dead end as well, because the accounts that we find in the Old Testament are real events that happen to real people at real places. They're historical narratives. They're not just stories that are concocted from human imagination. And part of the problem that the critic has is that they tend to read things in isolation from other biblical texts. But to do that is to come away with a skewed perspective of things. We need the whole of Scripture to discern a balanced and a reliable portrait of God's nature. And yet when we do that, it's not going to make the conquest, not going to turn it into a nice story. It's not going to eliminate all of the questions. What it does do is to help us connect the conquest to things that we do know about God, things that we're told about how He works in human history. And last, a couple of weeks ago on Sunday night, we began looking at some of the vital viewpoints. One of them is that the conquest is a part of the Old Testament story. And as such, it's very much in keeping with the language and the culture of ancient warfare of that world. The common rhetoric that sometimes made absolute claims about wiping out the entire enemy, and yet literally that was not the case. And we find examples of that in the book of Joshua, for example, where we find language that suggests that under Joshua's leadership, everything that lived and breathed was put to death. And yet, when we come to the opening chapters of the book of Judges, it's very clear that the subduing of the land's inhabitants wasn't fully achieved, that the Israelites are living among the Canaanites. Well, that obviously can't be the case if under Joshua's leadership they were entirely wiped out. And so when we read graphic descriptions of what was commanded or what was carried out or what was even achieved, we need to understand that not all of it was necessarily to be taken literally. The Bible also teaches that the conquest was a unique and it was a limited event. It was a single episode that took place in one generation out of numerous generations of Old Testament history. And the Old Testament obviously contains a number of other wars. Some were sanctioned by God, others were not. But in all of those wars, they weren't
all to be fought in the same way as the conquest was. The conquest of Canaan was what God wanted to occur at a particular time in a particular situation. It was not to be the ongoing pattern of how every subsequent generation of Israel was to behave toward their enemies. We also saw, or started last time, that it was an expression of divine justice. God acting in judgment on a wicked and depraved culture. Now, that doesn't change the facts. It doesn't minimize the violence of the conquest. But it should make a difference in how we see things, how we read it, how we understand it. We looked at Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16, where it tells us that God says to Abraham, look, I can't give you the land, and I can't give the land to your descendants yet, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. But when it became complete, then judgment would fall, and deservedly so. Again, that doesn't change the actions of the conquest, but the understanding that it takes place within a moral context where punishment is administered against sin should help to change our perspective. We realize that there's a difference between arbitrary violence that's done against innocent human beings and what is administered in a moral framework of justice. The second element that we looked at last time was that Israel's involvement didn't make them righteous. Deuteronomy over and again warns Israel about overestimating the evil of the Canaanites, while at the same time, don't underestimate your own evil. Just because you are agents in judgment against the Canaanites does not mean that you are the good guys, that you are perfect and you're righteous. I'm not giving you this land because you're such good folks. Now that brings us, and that's where we left off last time. So here we're sort of picking up from this point on. We also find that God threatened to do exactly the same thing to Israel. And he did it. Israel, before they ever begin the conquest of Canaan, God warns them that if they, once they get into the land, if they behave like the Canaanites, then God will treat them like the Canaanites. And he even uses some of the exact same terminology to describe what he will do to Israel if they behave like Canaan. Look at Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus 18, beginning in verse 26. Leviticus 18, verse 26, "But as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not do any of these abominations, neither the native nor the alien who sojourns among you. For the men of the land who have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled, so that the land will not spew you out, should you defile it, as it has spewed out the nation which has been before you." Turn from there to the book of Deuteronomy. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 28. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, the closing chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, the blessings and the curses, here we find in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 25. Deuteronomy 28, verse 25, "The Lord shall cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You will go out one way against them, but you will flee seven ways before them, and you will be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Your carcasses will be food to all the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth, and there will be no one to frighten them away." Skip down to verse 47 of the same chapter. Chapter 28, verse 47, "Because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and a glad heart for the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom the Lord will send against you in hunger, in thirst, in nakedness, in the lack of all things, and he will put an iron yoke on your neck until he has destroyed you." And we find much the same thing mentioned in Joshua chapter 23 and verses 15 and 16. The land vomited out the Canaanites, and it was just as capable of vomiting out the Israelites. That if they choose to indulge in the same repulsive practices, the same God who acts in moral judgment against Israel's enemies will act in moral judgment against them. Israel needed to understand, before they even go into the promised land, that the conquest is not just some charade. It's not an act of partisan favoritism. Israel stands under the same judgment coming from the same God in regard to the same sins if Israel should choose to commit them. And isn't it true that the bulk of what we see in the remainder of the Old Testament reveals that that was more than just an idle threat? That God repeatedly acts in judgment upon his own people. and oftentimes uses exactly the same terms that we see used in the conquest. And thus he demonstrates his moral consistency in regard to all people. They may be uniquely chosen, but they are not God's protected favorites. If they sin, he is not going to condone it. He is not going to overlook it. He is going to bring the same judgment. If they participate in the same sins that the Canaanites did, he will act in judgment upon Israel. And in reality, over the entire Old Testament history, there were far more Israelites who died at the hand of divine judgment than did the enemies of Israel in the single generation that we know of as the conquest. Another element, and this one was one that came to mind in the book of Deuteronomy as well. Look back at chapter 2 of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 2. And that is that the history of other nations is also being directed by God. There are two aspects of the conquest that are the most troubling. One is the amount of bloodshed that is involved. And the other is the fact that God commands it. That's something that's inescapable in the book of Deuteronomy and in other narratives. God commands Israel to do this. But does it really make that much of a difference theologically? If it's not a direct command that tells Israel to conquer Canaan, but God simply allows Israel to conquer Canaan. Or if the Canaanites were driven out by not Israel, but some other nation. Look at what he says here in chapter 2 and verse 10. This is talking about the Moabites. And he tells them in verse 9, look, you're not going to get the Moabite land. Verse 10, the Emim lived there formerly, a people as great and numerous and as tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are regarded as the Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. The Horites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave to them. Skip down to verse 18. Today, you should, and this has to do with the Ammonites. Today you shall cross over the border of Moab when you are opposite the sons of Ammon. Do not harass or provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession. It is also regarded as the land of the Rephaim, for the Rephaim formerly lived in it, but the Ammonites call them Zemzumim, a people as great and numerous and as tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, just as he did for the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They dispossessed them and settled in their place, even to this day. And the Avim, who lived in the villages as far as Gaza, and the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and lived in their place. Here we read of other invasions and other conquests that involve other nations in that same region around this same time. And because nothing takes place outside of God's knowledge and God's control, and we see the language here, all of this is managed by the God of Israel. But reading about one group of foreigners driving out and destroying another group of foreigners doesn't bother us because God didn't command them to do it. But doesn't the text make it very clear that God's hand is involved in this? That God rules over the movements of all nations like moving pieces on a chessboard in history. And in a sense, Israel's conquest of Canaan is not going to be any different than these others. In fact, he uses that same terminology. It is going to be in keeping with the will of God. Now, our problem is that we wanted to draw this very clear line of distinction between what God causes and what God allows. We want to draw a nice sharp line between His expressed will and His permissive will. And from our perspective, the difference between that is huge. But to the ancient mind of Old Testament Israel, there was very little distinction between them. Or if we were to phrase it another way, we readily affirm that things happen under the control of God. We want to draw a line of distinction between what God causes to happen and what God allows to happen. But the reality is reading that God commanded something doesn't put it in a dramatically different box than what God allows to happen. though it seems to us to be dramatically different, the ancient Jews didn't see it that way. When God occupies a less interventional role because he doesn't command it, that makes us feel better. But in the ancient mind, it still saw God's hand as involved in this. And we see that in here in Deuteronomy. How did those peoples get their land? How did the Moabites get their land? How did the Ammonites get their land? It wasn't just by military conquest. Yeah, military conquest was involved, but God is behind all of it, whether he simply allows it or whether he commands it. The third main vital viewpoint is that this ultimately is the fulfillment of God's plan of salvation. And as such, it is a theological necessity. God understands that if Israel lives alongside their Canaanite neighbors, that the worship of the one God is going to quickly be compromised and corrupted by the idolatrous practices of those around them. And as a result of that, the purity of their faith as an essential aspect of their unique message and their unique lifestyle would eventually be intermingled and mixed with elements of Baalism. Israel was destined to be God's unique instrument in keeping with God's purposes for them. They were the ones who were charged with faithfully communicating divine revelation to the rest of the world. And nothing could be allowed to dilute or to distort that distinctive message. And so as harsh as the conquest appears to us, it is actually Israel's neglect of this command, their complete fulfillment of it, that causes problems for perpetual generations of God's people. For 350 years in the book of Judges, the problem is that these people live alongside the Israelites. They don't and haven't kept God's command in regard to the conquest. That rather than doing what God told them to do, they allowed the Canaanites to live alongside of them. And I think an argument could be made that if they had actually fully obeyed the command in regard to the conquest, as severe as it was, that it would have prevented a much more extensive loss of life, both for Israel and for other nations later on in history. Life in a fallen world simply does not allow us to just make a choice between good and bad. Sometimes the choice is between a painful course of action that will eventually have a good effect, or a lackluster delay or inaction that has devastating consequences. There is also this element of blessing the nations. Ultimately, the goal toward which the Old Testament is heading is the blessing of all nations in keeping with the promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3. And the nation of Israel is a vital component of that marvelous project. And so throughout the Old Testament, we see this very clear line of distinction that's being drawn between the people of Israel and the rest of the nations. Israel is the group of people whom God had called, whom he had chosen, whom he had redeemed, who he had brought into a covenant relationship with himself, and the other nations didn't enjoy that kind of relationship. But the truth was that God's calling and his choosing and his redeeming and his bringing of Israel into a covenant relationship with himself was for the very purpose of enabling those other nations to enjoy that same kind of relationship themselves. And so we misread the story of the Old Testament if we think that it is telling us a story of Israel against the nations, because it's actually a story of Israel for the sake of the nations. That God's purpose is the ultimate blessing of all nations. And that didn't mean that he had to be nice to everybody in the process, no matter how they lived. God stands as the moral judge for all human action and all nations, including Israel. And his long-term purpose was the blessing of all nations, and that did not prohibit him from punishing or judging certain nations at specific moments in history as he is working toward that ultimate goal. There are several psalms, there are a number of prophecies that reference this very intention of God to bless the nations. I want to look at just two practical pieces of evidence that provide testimony. One is the conversion and the inclusion of foreigners within Israel. Stop and think about this. How interesting is it that in the opening narrative of Joshua, the book that chronicles for us the conquest of Canaan, The book doesn't start with a conquest. It starts with a conversion. The account of Rahab is very prominent in its position in the book. The length of that narrative attests to its importance. And in that narrative, we find a Canaanite who recognizes the power of Israel's God. And unlike all of the other Canaanites, she puts her faith in him and she changes side. Look at Joshua chapter 2. I want you to notice what Rahab says. Notice her words here. Joshua chapter 2, and let's begin our reading in verse 9. Joshua chapter 2, well, let's back up to verse 8. We find that now before they lay down, that's the two spies that have come into Jericho. This is Joshua 2 and verse 9. She came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. This is not just a case of survival. This is not about just self-preservation. Her words reveal a pretty deep theological understanding of what was being communicated by the Exodus, by the destruction of Sihon and Og, and even aspects of elements of creation. Rahab is an incredibly impressive woman that with very little revelation to work with, she has come to understand and to believe with confidence what God spent an entire generation trying to teach Israel. She gets it. The dead generation in the wilderness didn't. Here's a Canaanite who gets the meaning of the Exodus. And as a result of her faith and her response to her faith, both she and her household will be spared because she placed her trust in the God of Israel. And she becomes proof, living proof, that if you are a Canaanite and you renounce the gods of Canaan and you embrace the God of Israel, that you will be spared. That there is a way for the Canaanites to avoid destruction if they choose to. It's interesting that the very first Canaanite we meet is a committed and a converted one. She's delivered. She's not destroyed. And so important is Rahab's story that her name appears in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1. Her name appears in that great hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. And James in his letter in chapter 2 and verse 25 uses her as a marvelous example of faith acting, that faith works. And alongside Rahab, we can think of people like Ruth. We can think of Naaman. We can think of the widow of Zarah. There were others as we make our way through the Old Testament who came to faith in Israel's God and were blessed as a result. And that inclusion didn't just involve individuals. Surprisingly, there's even whole people who will be included in the covenant people of God. The Gibeonites will be one. Now, they will achieve it by way of deception in Joshua chapter 9. But the Jebusites will be another, that is the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They are regularly included in the nations of Canaan that Israel was to destroy, for example, in Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. And clearly that doesn't happen during the conquest because even when Joshua is older in age, they still have not dislodged the Jebusites from Jerusalem. In fact, that won't even happen until the days of David in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And then they won't be totally destroyed. In fact, it seems that they are absorbed into the tribe of Judah. And so here's a group of people in the Jebusites who were originally destined for destruction, but it seems that they are included among the covenant people of God and are included as a clan of Judah, according to Zechariah 9 and verse 7. The second piece of evidence has to do with the care of foreigners under the law of Moses. Many of them lived as resident aliens. They were very vulnerable because they lacked the natural protections of land and family. And yet the law contained very strong concern about their well-being. These resident aliens, these non-Israelites, were protected from oppression. They were protected from unfair treatment in courts of law. They were provided, as we saw in our study of Deuteronomy in chapter 5. They were included in that Sabbath rest instruction. They were involved in the worship and the ceremonies, in particular of the Passover. They were given economic benefits as they reaped some of the benefits of that every 3-year tithe in Israel. They had access to gleaning in the orchards and in the fields. And in fact, Israel is actually instructed to love the foreigner based on the example of God himself. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 18 and 19, he executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. Show your love to the alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. Leviticus 19 and verse 34, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now again, that doesn't reduce, and it certainly doesn't remove the violent conquest. But it does show that the conquest is a limited historical necessity. It's not an ongoing pattern of how Israel's behavior toward foreigners. And it could be changed. Just like Rahab, if you came to faith, then you weren't destroyed along with the others. And then third, it involves the praise of the peoples. As you read through the Old Testament, what does God have in mind for the nations? Judgment would be an accurate answer to that question. But that would also be true for Israel, wouldn't it? In fact, the majority of the Old speaks to God's judgment, not on the Canaanites, but on the Israelites. But the Old Testament message isn't just about judgment, is it? It's also about the promise of restoration and salvation. And that same hope is regularly held out to the nations. God promised that in Abraham, all of the nations of the earth would be blessed. And the entire movement of the Bible is driving toward that fulfillment in Jesus Christ when people from every nation would be included among the redeemed. Look at Psalm chapter 47. This will be the last passage we'll look at tonight. Psalm chapter 47. And I want you to notice what is said here about the conquest. Now, it's not going to be specifically, he's not going to say in the conquest, but that's what is in mind here. Chapter 47, beginning in verse 1. Psalm 47 and verse 1. He says, "Oh, clap your hands, all peoples. Shout to God with the voice of joy." And so here the nations, all peoples, are called upon to join in the applause for the God of Israel. And what's the applause for? Look at what he says. Verse 2. "For the Lord Most High is to be feared, a great king over all the earth. He subdues peoples under us and nations under our feet. He chooses our inheritance for us." That's a reference to the land. "The glory of Jacob, whom he loves." What were they to be applauding God about? That he subdued people under Israel and he brought about their defeat. Now, that psalm, that statement, is either nothing more than a case of military cynicism that masquerades as worship, or there's something else that's being conveyed here. And I think it's that something else that's being conveyed here, that this is a deep theological understanding of the conquest, that the nations can applaud God's actions because even the historical defeat of the Canaanites by Israel is ultimately a part of God's overall plan of salvation by which the nations ultimately will be saved and therefore praise God. In other words, the single account of the conquest has to be read within the much larger story of the Bible, a story that ultimately is moving toward all of the nations of the earth having reason to praise God and to thank Him for the salvation that is accomplished in Jesus. And Paul over in Romans chapter 15, in a section where he is emphasizing the fact that the gospel has gone to the Gentiles, quotes from that section of Psalm 47. And in reality, when you and I read Psalm 47, we're not reading it as Israelites, and we're not reading it as Canaanites. Whatever our heritage, we stand among the redeemed from all nations. And thus... determined to clap our hands and to give praise to our God for the fulfillment of His promise to Abraham. You and I are the beneficiaries of God bringing about that promise. This is the way that God chose to work within human history to accomplish His redemptive purposes for humanity. And we might not ever grasp why it needed to be that way. We might feel very uncomfortable with the way that it happened. But at some point, we have to step away from our questions and our criticisms and simply accept the Bible's verdict on the matter.
It was an act of God that transpired under an overarching narrative through which the hope of salvation could be extended to all peoples and all nations. Now, as we close, let's set the conquest in light of the cross. Because at the cross of Jesus, we find one of the most horrific and one of the most evil demonstrations of human violence ever perpetrated. Simultaneously, we see one of the greatest outpourings of divine wrath on human iniquity. And at the same time, the cross stands as the most profound demonstration of divine grace and love. God Himself bearing our sin in the person of His Son, who, unlike the Canaanites, deserved nothing of what He got. It wasn't because of His sin that the judgment and the wrath of God came. It was because of ours. Again, haven't answered every question. I don't think on this side of eternity we ever will. But I hope that giving you some things to think about, to see the big picture aspect of things, rather than just sort of isolating the events of the conquest. And ultimately, it boils down to us trusting in God. This was how He carried it out. I don't know why, but He did. And we believe that. And we trust that. And we believe Him. And we're a part of the beneficiary of that plan that was worked out, that we could stand as part of His redeemed. If you're not a Christian tonight, why not? Why not tonight? Let tonight be that moment in time when you come to this God who is great and who is wise, who works His eternal plan out to bring about the benefit and the blessing of all people and all nations. If we can help you to do that tonight, won't you come? Why don't we stand with Robert and sing?